Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today we're pleased to have as our guest Michael Cremo, who is the co-author, along with Richard Thompson, of The Hidden History of the Human Race, as well as the larger work, Forbidden Archaeology. The Hidden History of the Human Race is an abridged version of the findings of the larger work. And I was attracted to this because it is actually one of the books showing a disturbing trend in science of ignoring important evidence because of one's belief systems, bearing it. And it's not just science, it's also medicine and a lot of other things that impact our lives directly. If we're not willing to look at all of the evidence, we may have a very distorted view of what actually is, and we need to rethink this in terms of all of our disciplines. Michael is an author and researcher specializing in the history and philosophy of science, so he is particularly qualified to look at this problem. And he has teamed up with Richard Thompson, who has a PhD in mathematics, and he's the author of scientific books and articles on evolutionary biology. So this is a body of work that we're going to be talking about, but the implications of the scientific cover-up are very important for, I guess, revising our current way of doing business. Welcome, Michael. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleased to be with you and all your listeners.
So, you want to tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the cover-up in archaeology and how this relates to your mission and what you came to contribute to our world.
Well, this has a lot to do with the way I was brought up. My father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force, and that meant a couple of things for me as I was growing up. You know, I lived in different places in the United States and Hawaii, around the world, and I got exposed to a lot of different worldviews and cultures. So as I was growing up, I began to understand there's more than one way of looking at things. You know, for example, mm-hmm. when I was in first grade in Hawaii, my classmates were from Chinese backgrounds, Japanese backgrounds, Hawaiian backgrounds, African American backgrounds, Filipino backgrounds, a whole range of cultures and outlooks. So that was a very important influence on me as I was growing up. And of course, as I got older, although I had been exposed to a lot of different worldviews and cultural outlooks, you know, I had to begin to form my own. And one of the worldviews that I got exposed to that made a lot of sense to me was the spiritual worldview of ancient India, you know, with mm-hmm. its systems of yoga and meditation and the ideas of reincarnation and things like that. So I incorporated that into my worldview. And as I got deeper into studying the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which are collectively called the Vedas, I could see they gave accounts of human histories on this planet going back millions and millions of years, right back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. And this is something that can also be found in lots of other ancient wisdom traditions. Mm-hmm. Whether we're talking about Christianity or Buddhism or Islam or Australian Aboriginal traditions or whatever, they all tend to have the idea that humans have been present since the beginning of life on Earth. So I began to wonder about that. Was that simply mythology, or was there perhaps some factual basis for it? You know, because it was very astonishing to me. It was something completely different than I ever learned from any of my teachers in high school or university. So that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology.
You know, and just let our viewers know the traditional view. When does traditional archaeology say humans first appeared?
The traditional textbook archaeologist will say that first human beings like us came into existence less than 200,000 years ago. They would say before 200,000 years ago, there were no human beings like us on this planet. There were simply more primitive, ape-like human ancestors. And then before that, just primitive apes and monkeys. And before that, just very primitive little mammals. So that's the standard view, that humans like us only came into existence less than 200,000 years ago. But these ancient wisdom traditions are telling us like humans like us have actually been present since the very beginnings of life on Earth, going back many millions of years. So I was curious about that, whether those kinds of accounts are to be taken as, well, just mythology, or is there some factual basis to it? So that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology. Now, when you look in the current textbooks, you're only going to find evidence that goes along with the currently dominant view that humans like us first came into existence about 200,000 years ago, having evolved from more primitive ape-like human ancestors. But I decided to look beyond the textbooks. I decided to look at the original scientific reports in a lot of different languages. You know, because of the way I was educated and raised, I have a reading knowledge of a lot of different languages. So I started digging into the original scientific reports by archaeologists and other scientists who are digging into the earth. And I wanted to see what they were actually finding. When I started looking into those original reports, I found many reports of scientists finding human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints millions and millions of years old. So along with Richard Thompson, I collected those and published them in the book Forbidden Archaeology,
right,
and which we also brought out in a shorter edition, as you were mentioning, called The Hidden History of the Human Race. So that's how, you know, I got into that topic. And what it basically means is we need a whole new understanding of who we are on this planet, what we are as human beings, where we came from, what we really are. And ultimately, you know, I wrote another book to explain that. You know, if our history is different, we didn't evolve from the apes and monkeys, and we've always been here, then where did we come from? And I answered that question in another book that I wrote called Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And basically what I propose in that book is that ultimately we're beings of pure consciousness that originally existed on some higher level of reality. You know, matter did not produce consciousness. Consciousness has its own independent existence. It can come in contact with matter and become associated with matter, but consciousness has its own independent existence. So what I propose in this book is that as conscious beings, we do not evolve up from matter. Rather, we devolve or come down from a level of pure consciousness, and our purpose should be to restore consciousness to its original pure state beyond the world of matter.
I would love to interview you on that book at a later date. For, you know, a lot of the evidence, not just in what you have in your book, but there's a lot of other evidences that supports that view. You know, in terms
of, we can talk about forbidden archaeology today. There's no problem with that. But I, you know, just wanted to show.
Sure.
You were asking about my mission. Well, my ultimate mission is to show that we're beings of pure consciousness. But
right.
To get there, we've got to talk about stones and bones.
Right, right. Well, one of the great, one of the most fascinating things that I found in this particular book was the Precambrian evidence of the groove metallic sphere and the metal vase, which is from 600 to 2800 million years ago. And the metal vase was very, very inlaid with silver. And you want to talk about that a little bit? It was in Scientific America.
Yeah.
In 1852. I mean, this evidence would indicate that if, you know, some beings may have, now whether they lived on Earth or whether they were visiting Earth is another issue that you didn't get into in this book, but finding something that old that there was that complicated is very interesting.
Yeah, I did 8 years of research into the whole history of archaeology, looking into all the reports, not just what you see in the textbooks today. I wanted to look mm-hmm. at the entire scientific literature on discoveries related to human antiquity. So I tried to be very thorough. And that's one of the reports that I came across. It was a report that was published in Scientific American in the year 1852. It told of a beautiful metallic vase, which had silver inlaid floral patterns, and it was just a beautiful object, according to the report published in Scientific American. And it was found 15 feet deep in solid rock, where workmen were excavating, or really blasting out with dynamite, solid rock to excavate a foundation for a building they were constructing. So they, at that 15-foot level, that's 15 feet deep in solid rock that they had blasted out with dynamite, that's where this object was found. And so how we got the age for it was, we inquired from the United States Geological Survey, from their professional geologists, well, how old is the formation at that place, at that depth? This was in Dorchester, mm-hmm. which is near or part of Boston. And they said the formation at that location is called the Roxbury Conglomerate. And it dates back to the Cambrian period, going back about 600 million years. So that was really quite astonishing to find mm-hmm. a human artifact solidly embedded in layers of rock that are 600 million years old. That's really mm-hmm. quite astonishing from the standpoint of what the modern textbook version of human origins is. The modern textbook picture of human origins is there weren't any human beings like us until about 200,000 years ago. And really, they would say the first humans who were using metal to mm-hmm. make metal objects, that only started happening about 10,000 years ago, according
right.
to the current textbook versions. So to have this kind of evidence of a beautiful metallic vase going back hundreds of millions of years, about 600 million years, to the Cambrian period is really kind of interesting. It's just one of the facts that I uncovered as I was digging very deeply mm-hmm. into the whole history of archaeology.
So, we have mysteries, and like you said, the spiritual literature, not just the Vedas, but also other literature, would support that humans have lived here a long time, or even if they weren't having colonies here, they may have visited here as well. The ancient astronaut theories. Certainly, you know.
Right.
We don't know which one, but this vase indicates that somebody was here that was an advanced being anyway.
Yeah, what I tried to do in my book Forbidden Archaeology was just present the evidence without really trying to explain it. I figured I'll offer my explanation in some other book.
Right.
I wanted people to be free to think about this and come up with their own explanations. I mean, one thing is clear is that the current explanation that's in the textbooks is not going to accommodate this evidence. So now, as far as, I mean, people have proposed a lot of different things. One thing some people have proposed is time travel, that, you know, these objects may be the result of time travelers, or the extraterrestrial idea is another idea that which you mentioned. You know, that perhaps these early signs of a human presence on this planet were left by human-like visitors from other worlds. And the others have proposed, well, maybe there could be a new theory of evolution with the human beings evolving hundreds of millions of years ago rather than 200,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then another option is the one that I actually favors, namely that humans were here, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago. And I think the real story, it may be, you know, it may have to involve all, you know, various combinations of all those things. I mean, it, one of them doesn't rule out another. But my own favored way of looking at it is that where there were human populations hundreds of millions of years ago that were native to this Earth, and they were responsible for those things. That doesn't rule out. I also believe there's life on other planets. There are human-like species all over the universe. So the humans on this planet could have been in contact with visitors from other levels of reality or other planets, other places in the cosmos. So I don't think it has to be an either-or sort of thing. It could be both.
And I think it's important to understand there could have also been different cycles where, in a very ancient cycle, humans got to a certain level of sophistication and then kind of were forced back by, you know, great changes, floods, asteroids, whatever you want to call it.
I accept that idea, definitely.
Right, because otherwise, you know, a lot of the evidence in your book has to do with finding certain bones and fossilized fragments of, you know, like the bones in conjunction with the tools, you know, in terms of the same area. So that kind of gives you the idea of what kind of tools the people with those bones were using. So it gives you an idea of the level of civilization. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, but here's something. It may not give a complete picture. Because let's say 100 million years ago, there were some people who were, some human persons, who were making use of stone tool technology, stone spear points, stone mortars and pestles and things like that. And let's say at the same time, there were also people using laptop computers and all kinds of other things. Now, what would be left for us to see 100 million years later, you know, if we're digging into the Earth? The stone tools are still going to be there. The laptop computers wouldn't be there because the plastics will dissolve, the metals will oxidize. So we're not really getting a complete picture of what was there in the ancient past by looking at what we can find in the layers of rocks today. because a lot of stuff really doesn't preserve for very long in the layers of rock. You know, that, you know, like I said, if you have a stone tool, well, it'll last millions of years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not going to break down. But something made of metal and plastic will dissolve away, erode away.
How do you explain
away.
How the silver cup didn't dissolve?
Well, it said it had silver inlaid mm-hmm. patterns in it. There can be rare instances where something is caught up in such a way that oxygen doesn't get to it.
Mm-hmm.
That can happen. But, yeah, sometimes people will be asking, well, gee, you know, like, if there were all these advanced civilizations in the past, why don't we see more evidence for them?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons, I mean, there have been studies have been done by scientists recently. They've been wondering, you know, because they're concerned about the environment. You know, our human civilization today with its huge cities and automobiles mm-hmm. and airplanes and all this technology and industrialization has really created a lot of environmental problems. You know, we've kind of poisoned the air, poisoned the land, poisoned the water, driven species to extinction, and you know, done a lot of damage to the environment.
Right.
So some scientists are wondering, what if human beings disappeared today? How long would it take the Earth to return to a natural state? And there have
mm-hmm.
been scientific studies done on this, and there have been documentaries that have aired on, you know, the National Geographic Channel and the Discovery
mm-hmm.
Channel. One of them was called World Without Us.
Right.
What they've concluded is, you know, that the remains of our huge technological civilization would only last a few thousand years.
Right.
And then
mm-hmm.
gradually, you know, like, the metals would oxidize,
yeah.
I mean, that means rust, like, or,
right.
or decay.
Fall apart, like an old car.
Fall apart. And, you know, rivers would, you know, when we don't have our water control systems in place, there'll be rivers just kind of flooding their banks and tsunamis
mm-hmm.
and all kinds of things like that. You can even just see it, you know, in a city. You know, if you look at an old sidewalk, you know, the weeds start
mm-hmm.
getting there, the roots of the trees start breaking it up, it just starts
mm-hmm.
breaking into pieces. So, and then fires would sweep through whatever ruins were there, and glaciers
burn
would
everything,
come down,
yeah.
you know, glaciers would come down.
Mm-hmm.
So after, you know, a few hundred thousand years, there wouldn't be very much left. And after
yeah.
millions and millions of years, hardly anything at all. So,
do you think the marble would be left? I mean, these big marble statues.
Marble could possibly be left. Now, it would depend
mm-hmm.
on whether those things got preserved or not.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, marble,
like buried in dirt. Buried in dirt would preserve them, but being exposed might not. I mean,
yeah,
marble would wear.
Marble itself will corrode.
Right. Yeah.
You know, after thousands and thousands of years, that is not something granite. You know, something made of granite that's more
mm-hmm.
likely to be preserved, like
mm-hmm.
limestone, you know, marble, you know, things like that. That's a different type of rock.
Yeah,
but,
just look at the Sphinx. It's eroded quite a bit.
Yeah, but it would. Yeah,
but it's still there.
Longer than so that will last. But if we're talking about millions of years, it might not still be there.
No, right.
But so my point was that we can't expect to get a complete picture of what the past was like from what's there in the layers of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
We're only getting a selective picture. And the further back in time you go, the more ancient layers of rock you go, you're going to find less and less. Not because less
mm-hmm.
was originally there, but because over millions of times, millions of years, more and more of what was originally left gets destroyed or
right.
it disappears.
Right.
So that's one of the issues that you have to deal with. However, that's not the only way we can learn about the past. We can also look at the records left by, ancient civilizations, like the historical accounts in the writings of these different ancient civilizations. And say if we look at the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, they present a picture of a long history, the deep history of the world, more or less in the same terms that you were describing, vast cycles of time that mm-hmm. repeat again and again and again. And in these vast cycles of time, civilizations rise and fall many different times.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that basic idea that you mentioned, just a minute or two ago, is really true, that time is cyclical. Civilizations rise and fall many times. And these ancient Sanskrit writings describe, these ancient civilizations. There were cities, people had flying machines, spaceships, they were called vimanas. They understood the atom, they could tell time by the movement of atoms. They had, weapons resembling, modern nuclear weapons. They were quite advanced, even though they were existing millions of years ago. But not all of that is going to be found in the record of the mm-hmm. rocks, because a lot of stuff just doesn't preserve over millions of years.
And it could be buried, it could be buried way under the ocean. This could be millions in like 200 million years ago the civilizations themselves could have been sunk into the ocean easily.
We really haven't really looked. If you look at all the layers of rock that there are, mm-hmm. we've only looked at a tiny fraction of it. And but my point in forbidden archaeology was that even though the archaeological record is very imperfect, what is there, what has been found, definitely contradicts the textbook picture of human origins, because there are many reports of human bones, human artifacts, mostly of stone, but a few of metal, being found, and human footprints being found that are millions and millions of years old. So it shows that millions of years ago there were human beings. Now, for all the details about their level of culture or civilization or how their civilizations rose and fell, I think that's a topic for a future generation of researchers. Nobody's really trying to do research to answer questions like that now, because among the mainstream scientists, it's just a kind of question that will never arise, because they don't think human beings were existing that far in the past. The archaeologists that are working today are all doing their work in the later periods, trying to work out details of their current theories. So
it's an interesting problem, and it actually exists in all fields of science. The things that, even though there's great evidence for stuff that doesn't fit into their worldview, and usually it's because their worldview is limited to three dimensions. And if they would consider that there's a multidimensional world out there that there's plenty of evidence for, they might be able to explain things better, like all the miracles and all the the things that science just doesn't want to look at.
Yeah, Dr. Kolb. I call it a process of knowledge filtration, which operates on the basis that you were speaking about. Namely, scientists may have certain deeply held theories and beliefs about the world and reality. And evidence that goes along with their deeply held views will pass through this knowledge filter very easily, which means that kind of information will make its way into the textbooks. You'll see scientists talking about it on television. If you go to the museum, you'll see the this kind of stuff in the exhibits. But if you've got evidence that radically contradicts the dominant views, it tends to get filtered out, just put aside, ignored, sometimes actively suppressed. So I call this process knowledge filtration. And once I was giving a lecture about this at a university in South Africa. I went to South Africa a few years ago and I spoke at a university there. My audience was about 100 professors from this university. And it was really interesting because I was talking about my book, Forbidden Archaeology, and this archaeological evidence that contradicts the current theories. And I was also speaking about this process of knowledge filtration. So after the lecture, I was kind of standing around, and one of the professors walked up to me. He kind of looked over his shoulder, made sure nobody else was listening, and he said, "You know, Mr. Creamer, I'm very happy that you gave this talk about this knowledge filtering process." He says, "It's going on in my field. I'm in chemistry, and let me tell you about it." You know, and he kind of went on about it. And then he went away. And then another professor walked up to me and kind of looked around, made sure nobody else was listening, and said, "You know, Mr. Creamer, you're talking about this knowledge filtering process. It's going on in my field, physics, and let me tell you about it." So I think you're absolutely right, Dr. Kolb, that it is something that goes on not just in archaeology, but in a lot of different fields: medical science, biological science, physical science, cosmology, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a book called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, another sacred cow that medicine doesn't want to disturb. And all I did was take peer-reviewed literature from, you know, neurology, cardiology, rheumatology, toxicology, plastic surgery. I took all the peer-reviewed literature and put it in one place. Guess what? Paints a very interesting picture. Then I added my clinical evidence, which was about 2,000 patients, and put that in. Well, my book is not well received. As you could imagine, that your book wouldn't be well received by university archaeologists that had a stake in the status quo, especially if they were making money off of it.
Yeah. Now, all scientists aren't like that, I have to say.
No, they aren't. It's just the ones that are very third-dimensional.
Yeah, some are a little bit open-minded. You know,
right,
for example,
exactly.
I've been able to give talks about my work, present papers about my forbidden archaeology work at meetings of the European Association of Archaeologists, meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, which is one of the world's largest international organizations of archaeologists. So there are some who are open-minded and they're willing to listen. Now, I'm not saying that they immediately start to agree with me, but at least they're open-minded enough to listen to me in their professional circles. And sometimes they publish some of my papers and things like that. So there is that element. There is this other element, which I've encountered and you've encountered, which are very fixed in their ideas, and they're not even willing to give a serious hearing to any.
Or look at the evidence, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
They call themselves scientists and researchers, but they won't look at the evidence.
Well, they just assume that something must be wrong with it.
Right, before looking at it, which is interesting.
Before looking at it. I had an experience like that once. I was... some open-minded scientists invited me to give a talk about my work at a meeting of the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow, in the Department of Anthropology and Archaeology. So I was speaking to them there, you know, my book had been translated into Russian, so some of them had read it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the archaeologists said to me, well, you know, after I talked, you know, there was a question session. So one of the archaeologists, you know, she stood up and she said, well, Professor Cremo, I haven't read your book, but I'm sure everything in it is a hoax or a mistake.
And she's not going to read it either.
Yeah, you know, because that's yeah. one mentality. That's one mentality. Now, fortunately,
yeah.
they're not all like that. You know, there are some open-minded ones who are at least
mm-hmm.
willing to listen. And I think that's important, because if ideas are going to change, the very first step is there have to be some scientists who are willing to listen to alternative or new ideas. So that's there. And then there's another group which might actually agree with me. And these tend to be scientists who have experienced this knowledge filtering process themselves.
Mm-hmm.
One example, you know, I can give is Virginia Steen McIntyre. She's a geologist. And in the 1970s, when she was just beginning her career in geology, she was a rising star in her profession. She had invented a new dating method. She was getting grants. She was getting invitations to speak at big international conferences. You know, she had a
mm-hmm.
teaching position at a university. You know, she was a rising star in her profession of geology. And then she was called to date an archaeological site in Mexico called Huayatlaco. It's in central Mexico near Puebla. And there, some, you know, a team of archaeologists had uncovered human artifacts in some ancient layers of rock, and they wanted to know how old they were. So they called a team of geologists to the site to tell them how old it was. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues used four scientific methods to date the site, and they came up with an age of 300,000 years. But the archaeologists said that's impossible, because human beings just didn't exist.
You know, we know that.
Capable of making those artifacts didn't exist 300,000 years ago. So they refused to publish the age for the
mm-hmm.
site given by their own hand-picked team of geologists. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues were just a little shocked by this. So they
mm-hmm.
independently published the age for the site
mm-hmm.
in a scientific journal. But when they did that, they experienced an extreme negative backlash from their colleagues in the scientific world, because they had dared to publish something that contradicted the dominant Darwinian evolutionary theory
mm-hmm.
of human origins. And, you know, she lost a teaching position that she held at the university, and her career, which up to that point had been rising rapidly,
mm-hmm.
just hit the ceiling, you know, hit a roadblock. And it's so sometimes, you know, that can happen.
There are casualties.
You know, yeah, there are casualties. And,
yeah.
And sometimes it's people who have really experienced what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to agree with me, you know.
Sure.
Those
oh, yeah.
who've experienced it themselves, not just those, but among those who have ran into this knowledge filter themselves, you know, they can see what I'm talking about and they can agree. So,
well, that's true, and it does happen in all fields. And in plastic surgery, there are probably hundreds of thousands of women who are ill with undiagnosed treatable diseases, misdiagnosed with MS, lupus, and all sorts of things that aren't very treatable. And so sometimes it's not just the doctors and the scientists that are, you know, that are on. Put out to dry. It's actually the patients. Which that's what pisses me off more than anything, you know. You know, this is an iatrogenic disease, and that means doctor-caused, okay? It's plastic surgeons that put the implants in. So for the medical profession to ignore the evidence and discredit the women, saying that they're all hysterical and just want money from the settlements, is particularly distasteful to me.
Mm-hmm. Is there any progress on that front? I haven't really dug deep.
Not really.
Myself, but I seem to recall in the news recently something about from Europe, from France.
Yeah, the PIP implants were made with more industrial-grade silicone and chemicals that weren't supposed to be in there because they actually helped dissolve the shell, so they ruptured easily. And that person is in apprehended, and I guess is the head of that company is facing charges. But the women, some countries are taking the implants out, others aren't. Many of them are saying the same thing. There's no real evidence that the women are being hurt, although that's not true. And then yesterday, the FDA announced it was going to approve a third silicone implant. The two manufacturers now are Mentor, which are owned by Johnson & Johnson, and Allergan, which is the makers of Botox and other products. So there's a third, less well-known company that is vying for FDA approval. And the studies are going to be done for 10 years. Now, you might ask, why 10 years? And I'll tell you, 10 years is the lifetime of the shell. The engineering data from Dow Corning showed that the shell starts to disintegrate after 10 years. So women generally don't get sick unless they just have the HLA type that can't take silicone at all or gets infected. The saline component gets infected or the capsule gets infected. But in general, the silicone gel implants, the women will stay pretty healthy for 10 years unless the shell degrades earlier. So that's why they chose 10 years. So what I always said, you know, I've been paid as a scientist. I was a researcher at Hopkins and at Washington University. If I know all the variables, I can design an experiment to show that anything's safe. You know, it's not a problem.
For a limited period of time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or if you're not taking into account certain variables.
Right. If you decide not to conclude certain variables in your study, then you can show that arsenic is safe, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, people don't understand the scientific method. They don't understand how complicated it actually is to do a study. I just don't get it. Because they haven't done it. They trust the scientists. So anyway, are you still there?
Oh, yeah, I'm still there.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Waiting for you to kind of conclude.
To do the next question, yeah. No, I changed positions, and sometimes this phone unhooks, which I was worried it did. So would you mind giving your contact information and any schedules, lecture schedules or anything that you might have?
Well, if people are interested in that, they could have a look at my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com, and there's a schedule link there and an interview link there. And on my schedule link, they'll have upcoming lectures and events, like next week I'll be giving a couple of talks at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. And later in the year, I've got other events coming up. Actually, in December, I'm going to be a speaker on a cruise that's going to the Mayan sites in Central America in December 2012. And that's also on my schedule link at that, and you know, people could have a look at that if they're interested in participating in that. So that would be the main stop for learning about either other books that I've written or my upcoming lecture schedule or interview schedule. Like if somebody had looked at my interview schedule, they would have seen this interview with you listed okay. on there. So that, and then people can also leave mail for me on my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com. So that would be the best place. I also have a Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter. But I think a good stop would be my website, personal website, mcremo.com.
And when you mentioned that you had a third book come out, which goes into more detail about explaining what you're finding in forbidden archaeology, would you like to mention that book again and a little bit about what that book is about?
After I wrote Forbidden Archaeology and its abridged version, The Hidden History of the Human Race, giving archaeological evidence that contradicts the current Darwinian evolutionary theories of human origins, people started asking me, well, if we didn't evolve from the apes, if we've been here for millions and millions of years, then where did we come from? So to answer that question, I wrote a book called Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory, because it's based on my studies of the Vedas, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And basically what I say in that book is, you know, before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Now today, many scientists are going to say that a human being or any other living thing is just a machine made of molecules. That's all there is to it, just a complex arrangement of the chemical elements. That's what we are. Mm-hmm. But I would say there's more to a human being than the chemical elements. I think there's a subtle mind element with some very unusual powers, and there's a conscious self that can exist apart from the body, apart from the brain. And when I speak of mind and consciousness, I don't mean temporary byproducts of bioelectrical activity in the brain. Mm-hmm. I mean real things with their own independent existence. Today, the dominant scientific theory is that consciousness is produced by chemicals in the brain. It has no independent existence. And I just don't accept that. I think consciousness has its own independent existence. And it's consciousness originally exists on a level of the cosmos I call the level of pure consciousness. And it's not produced by matter, but it can become associated with matter. And when it becomes associated with matter, it becomes limited in different ways. The coverings of matter, which are our bodies, are actually vehicles for conscious selves, and those vehicles mm-hmm. have a purpose. The purpose is not to become over-involved in the production and consumption of more and more material things. The mm-hmm. purpose of the human vehicle is ultimately to restore consciousness to its original pure state beyond matter. So the basic message of this book, Human Devolution, is that as conscious beings, we don't evolve up from matter. Rather, we devolve or come down from the level of pure consciousness. But that process of devolution is something that can be reversed. And there can be an evolution of consciousness, restoring it to its original pure state. So that's what that other book is about.
Right. And this is the great in and out breath of Brahma, you know, the great cycles. And also, I don't know if you've read the Keys of Enoch, but in the Keys of Enoch, which is revelation material, not scientific or historical material, it talks about the blueprint of the Adam Kadmon, which is the blueprint of man, descending through the various dimensions and then becoming corrupted at the last point of entry by dark force energies that had agendas with it. And then so the idea that it is even more corrupted than it was supposed to be, which is an interesting idea. Certainly there's evidence of that now on the planet, I think. you know, the people who just have no compassion and no idea of anything other than themselves.
Yeah, so. I think you can find echoes of these ideas in a lot of different traditions. Yeah, you know, I don't personally
right.
claim to have any monopoly on truth. I think truth can be found
right.
in a lot of different places, and I think one chapter of my book, Human Devolution, is a cross-cultural study of cosmologies where I look
mm-hmm.
at the cosmologies of about 30 different cultures widely separated in time and space, you know, African tribal cultures, North American Indian cultures, the ancient Greeks, Romans, Egyptians,
mm-hmm.
So on and so forth. And they all tend to have similar ideas as far as I can see. And I think that's because they're all looking at the same reality. And of course, their accounts are going to be a little bit different.
Right.
Like the account in the Book of Enoch and the account in the Vedas and
mm-hmm.
an Australian Aboriginal account are going to be slightly different because I think these different peoples are looking at this same reality from a different perspective, just like
yeah.
if you had a mountain. Some people are looking at it from the east, some people are looking
mm-hmm.
from the west, some from the north, some from the south. So if they give their descriptions, there are going to be two things.
Right.
One thing
right.
is it's going to be obvious they're talking about the same thing, the mountain, but their descriptions are going to be a little bit different because they're looking at it from different angles or points of view.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important, you know, important way to look at things, too, is to look cross-culturally and look at various points of view, especially when what we're looking at is not concrete. It's not totally third-dimensional. The concepts aren't totally third-dimensional. So we have to look at it, you know, historically like you are, and I think through understanding that there is more than just our three-dimensional world. So I look forward to interviewing you in that book. I think that'll be great. So we'll get you on again for that one.
I'm looking
if that's
forward
okay with
to
you.
It as well.
Great. Well, we're coming up to the end of our hour. We've been interviewing Michael Cremo, who is the author of The Hidden History of the Human Race, which is a condensed version of a larger volume of work called Forbidden Archaeology. Michael has some very important concepts, not just for archaeology, but for science in general. And I put in my two cents about medicine as well. The idea of information filtration. Is that right, Michael?
I call it knowledge filtering, but information filtering works as well.
Yeah, knowledge filtration, where you only look at that knowledge and evidence that agrees with your worldview. Especially for publication and the advancement of textbook science. This is a very important concept because this is something that I think we need to look at all of our institutions and perhaps change this problem of knowledge filtration. Next week we will have Paul von Voorde back. He has a book called We've Never Been Alone, A History of Extraterrestrial Intervention, which is actually another piece to this puzzle. And then Robert Foreman on the 24th will be talking about enlightenment, Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be. And on the 31st, Leigh Fortson, Embrace, Release, and Heal, an empowering guide to talking about, thinking about, and treating cancer. Noetic Science Meeting, our guest speaker will be Dr. Fatemi, who wrote a book called The Episode of Life, Consciousness, Creation, and the Universe. And he will be presenting this at the Dunwoody office at 7:15 on Thursday, March 15th. He graduated from London University with a degree in chemistry. And the last 35 years, he's been studying metaphysics. He wrote Key to the Supreme World and Passage to Beyond Thought, and basically is studying consciousness, similar to what Michael is studying. Everybody's coming at this from different angles. And then I wanted to remind everybody about the I Can Do It retreat. It's a motivating mind, body, and soul event coming to Atlanta, San Jose, Vancouver, and Toronto. In the upcoming months, Dr. Wayne Dyer, Dr. Greg Braden. Actually, we're going to be interviewing Greg in April as well. Marianne Williamson, Cheryl Richardson, Louise Hay, Carolyn Mace will be there. If you will go to icandoit.net to find out the dates for a city near you, or call 1-800-654-5126. Well, thank you very much, Michael, for joining us. Appreciate you coming on and look forward to our next interview.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kolb, and thanks to all your listeners.
Thank you. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.